decided he will meet the Dalai Lama next week. The liberals delicately described the Tibetan monk as a spiritual leader rather than a political one. Still, the Chinese embassy in Ottawa is describing the meeting as a drastic departure from Canada's policy towards Tibet, raising fears of economic reprisals from the Asian superpower. To talk about Martin's delicate dance with the Dalai Lama, we're joined by Charles Burton. He's professor of political science specializing in China at Brock University, and he also worked for several years as a counselor in economic and political affairs for the Canadian embassy in Beijing. And he's on the line from St. Catharines, Ontario. Good afternoon.
Hi, Heidi.
Now, how might this meeting affect Canada's relationship with China?
I don't think that there will be a substantive change in the relationship because of this meeting. I think the Chinese are pretty confident of their place in the world, and I don't think that they're going to be terribly shaken by our Prime Minister having a talk with the Dalai Lama. The kind of reprisals that they might engage in would be with regard to our developmental aid program in the Tibetan Autonomous Region, Canada. That does some work there with poverty alleviation and improving agricultural productivity, and I suppose that the Chinese might give us trouble over getting permission to continue those projects, but that I don't think that's necessarily the case. I'm hoping that nothing will happen.
So if that's the case, why is China making waves about this visit then?
Well, they take their territorial integrity very, very seriously, and they don't want the Dalai Lama to be given the prestige of being a political leader in Tibet, and meeting with Prime Minister Martin does give that sort of impression because Mr. Martin's a political leader. In other words, one would expect that if the Dalai Lama was a spiritual leader only, he'd be meeting with Canadian spiritual leaders and not with our political leader. And also because the Chinese are concerned about other movements in their country that are seeking independence, you know, the Taiwan situation where there's a movement afoot to make a Republic of Taiwan separate from China, or they have a Inner Mongolian Autonomous Region, which is under Chinese sovereignty, but there is a country called Outer Mongolia to the north of it, and a lot of people in Inner Mongolia would like to join Outer Mongolia and form a Mongolian Republic. And then they've got the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, where a lot of people there would like to form a new state called Greater Turkestan, which would be apart from the sovereignty of Beijing. So I think they feel that if they show flexibility on one, that problems could occur with the others.
What do you think of the fact that the liberals are describing, you know, the Dalai Lama as a spiritual leader and not going near the politics of this and saying they're not going to take a stance on Tibet?
Well, I think that's, you know, a political ploy. Mr. Blair did the same thing when he met the Dalai Lama. The American president, Mr. Bush, didn't make any of these kinds of qualifications. I think the reason that Mr. Martin is meeting the Dalai Lama is because Canadians want to show support for the plight of the Tibetan people in Tibet, and they want our leader to show this by a symbolic gesture of greeting the Dalai Lama when he comes to our country, and I think that's what this is really all about. I don't expect anything substantive in the discussions between Mr. Martin and the Dalai Lama, and I don't think that Mr. Martin's spiritual views are probably of high interest to the Dalai Lama in the sense of that kind of exchange. So it's more about, symbolism.
So if this is about optics, why is the Dalai Lama wanting to meet with the Prime Minister if it's not going to mean anything?
Well, I think that he wants, he hopes that Canada can try and mediate between the Tibetan government in exile in India and the Chinese. I think he's doing everything he can to try and strengthen the international assessment of him as a legitimate leader in Tibet. And so, you know, it's a gradual process of one thing after another, a kind of water torture on Beijing's claim to sovereignty over Tibet. But I don't think that, he did say that if he can meet political leaders, he's happy to meet them, and if they're unable to meet with him, he understands. So it doesn't seem to be something that has great world significance in terms of geopolitical things. It seems to be mostly about keeping the profile of the problems in Tibet in the media and in the minds of people throughout the world.
What does the Dalai Lama want now for Tibet?
Well, he's not calling for an independent state. You know, he doesn't want a seat in the UN and its own flag. What he would like would be that Tibet be a genuine autonomous region where domestic affairs are managed by Tibetans and not by the Chinese as they are now. But he is prepared that that China should look after foreign affairs and defense, so Tibet would stay part of China. But the Chinese government is not having any of this, and they see the Dalai Lama's statements as simply a means for him to make inroads towards what they regard as his ultimate goal, which is to take China, Tibet away from China and form an independent state.
Why is China holding on to Tibet so, I don't know if stubbornly is the right word, but...
Well, I think a lot of Chinese, most Chinese probably see that their China includes Tibet, similar to the attitude that Canadians have towards Quebec in Canada. And so I think that the popular will is that the Chinese government should maintain Tibet as a part of a sovereign China. And then, as I said, the problem is that if China was to let Tibet go, that there are many other parts of China that might also want to become independent of China, and it's sort of the sorcerer's apprentice thing. One thing leads to another. And so I think the Chinese government takes a very strong line on Tibet because of this.
What would have to happen in order for the Tibetan people to gain more rights, to get closer to what the Dalai Lama is looking at?
Well, I think that if a middle class formed in Tibet, and if you had Tibetans with a degree of international education, money, and a sense of themselves as citizens with inherent rights, including the right to self-determination, that you might see an effective political movement form within Tibet that would be difficult for the Chinese government to continue to ignore. But we're really dealing at a high level of hypotheticals here, because the Tibetans in Tibet are mostly in the economic underclass, and any middle class that exists in China, the kind of people that run factories and own shopping centers, are ethnic Chinese. So the Tibetan people don't have really a strong sense of political consciousness to demand that they have their own political institutions run by Tibetans in Tibet.
Now, I know we're kind of talking hypotheticals here, but what would have to happen in order for there to become a middle class in Tibet? I'm just thinking it seems like they would be a long ways from that.
Well, you need to have better education available for Tibetans and increasing economic prosperity and opportunities for Tibetans to form their own networks of business. And that may happen in the years ahead. Certainly, the economy in Tibet is doing relatively well. There is a lot of development there, and a lot of Tibetans are interested in, being modern. They, particularly, young Tibetans want MTV and modern clothes and consumer electronics and all those kinds of things that modern people everywhere have. And to get that, you have to generate income to be able to afford the satellite dish to watch your MTV from Lhasa. And so this could be something that would lead to the rise of an empowered Tibetan class that would be culturally nationalistic and would demand that they have political rights in their own territory.
Charles Burton, thank you very much for this.
Great to talk to you.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Charles Burton is a professor in political science at Brock University, and he worked as a counselor in political and economic affairs for the Canadian Embassy in Beijing in 1990.